What's the best kind of ship that never sinks?
If you say what I think you're gonna say.
A friendship.
Oh my god. Not even original. When that first came on the scene, I thought it was quite cute, but now it just makes you think of like Live, Laugh, Love.
And on that note, welcome to Pros Before Hoes.
The podcast where we talk about what we're thinking, drinking, and reading.
Live, laugh, love.
Blech.
What have you been up to this week, my sweet little angel, looking adorable in your dungarees?
I literally look a child as well because I've got lemons on my socks.
You're in full top, you've got a scrunchie in your hair.
I am, that is, I dress the same as I did when I was a toddler, and I think that real style suits every age.
Style is eternal? Question mark?
Eternel?
Eternel in French.
You can't go wrong with denim dungarees.
No, I walked into your room this morning and we had both decided to wear denim dungarees this morning. And I'll tell you what, people, we had not made that decision intentionally.
No, definitely
We are
not.
in sync.
I imagine you will want a photo of us in our dungarees and our fleeces.
We always say we're gonna do content of like photos of you and I, and then we simply do not. What are you drinking? What are you drinking this week?
I am drinking Penny Pot cider.
Where'd you get that from? Did you get that from the Oval Farmers Market?
I did indeed. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I listen to you sometimes.
Sometimes.
Truly, emphasis on the sometimes.
It's very nice. I thought it was gonna be flat and like a scrumpy vibe. It is a scrumpy vibe, but it's quite light and it's like lightly sparkling.
Yeah.
So yeah, big fan.
Scrumpy is not a word that I'm familiar with. What does that mean?
I can't believe you went to Bristol Uni and you don't know what scrumpy is.
Look, I don't drink beer or cider. I have cider sometimes. I have cider with blackcurrant, like a child.
Scrumpy is just sort of like a farm cider that is very strong.
Okay.
Like at the Apple.
Yeah.
You know, Old Bristolian.
Yeah.
That's scrumpy.
Okay.
Scrumpy vibes.
Okay.
Oh my god, I miss the Apple so much. Let's move on.
Moving on swiftly so Elle doesn't cry live on the podcast.
It's been so long since I was last in Bristol. Only in the pandemic would we only have had one party in this house. And only in the pandemic would I have not been in Bristol for over a year. Carry on. I'm fine.
I didn't plan on what I was going to drink, so I've just pulled some random stuff from our bar cart and I've not yet sampled what I've made. I'll go through the ingredients first. I don't think it can go wrong.
No, I don't think it can go wrong.
I think, to be fair, this is probably already a cocktail. 40 milliliters of citrus, so lime and lemon.
Like getting actual measurements.
Yeah, 10 milliliters of sugar syrup, 40 milliliters of gin, and 20 milliliters of creme de cassis.
Did you forget how to read that then?
Yeah. I was like, what words? And you shake that bad boy in a Boston shaker, and then I strained it, and I've gone for no ice. There was ice in the shaker, but not in my glass. So let's have a little sample. I've made Ribena.
Have you put too much creme de cassis in? And sugar syrup. Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think that through. This is incredibly sweet.
You made alcoholic Ribena.
I made alcoholic Ribena.
I imagine.
I don't hate it.
No, I imagine. I imagine that's dangerous, though.
That tastes a bit like undiluted Ribena.
Yeah, that tastes like squash.
I was incredibly proud of myself, and I no longer am.
It's nice. I feel like it just needs maybe like some...
Need to...
You could put soda water in it, and then it would be less syrupy.
Yeah. I need to fiddle a bit around with those measurements, but I'll get back to you guys, perhaps with a new and improved...
I like the confidence of, I'm going to give you the measurements.
Yeah. Before I've even tried it. Ignore those measurements. This is not a good cocktail. I'll finish it though. It tastes like sugar.
Yeah, it's just syrupy. It's not bad, it's just very sweet.
Speaking of suspicious liquids, I don't know. Have you seen Orlando Bloom's morning routine?
I read the first para and then I stopped because...
Because it's ridiculous.
Well, it is, but the caption... I saw it on Twitter with the caption like... Oh my god, the most insane thing I've ever read. So with that caption, I was underwhelmed, but I was picking up on it was making me feel very uncomfortable. I got to the bit about he used a term about looking his child in the eye or something, and I was
never
like,
never look a child in the eye.
Well, no, it's just more like, you're just being a parent. Why have you coined a phrase? Are you going to read it all out to me?
I'm not going to read the whole thing out because it is quite long and broadly ridiculous. I'm going to read some of my favourite parts, which don't require any context, because even with context, they do not make any more sense. So Orlando Bloom talks about waking up at 6:30. He's a Capricorn, so routine is important to him. The first thing he does...
He says that. Yeah. He says, I'm a Capricorn, so routine is important to me.
Yeah, he does. He then chants for 20 minutes. He doesn't say what... He doesn't go into specifics about what he's chanting. Just chants.
Do we think it's, like, affirmations, or do we think it's, like, Buddhism? I think Buddhism.
So he then goes on to say, I'll read a bit of Buddhism.
Hey!
And then I'll type it up and add it to my Instagram stories.
Wow, maybe so I should follow
looking,
him.
Yeah, if you're looking for some daily Buddhist affirmations, head to Orlando Bloom's Instagram.
Wow.
He's more than his abs, guys.
I'm going to look this up as you speak.
He says he likes to earn his breakfast, so he'll have some green powders that he likes to mix with brain octane oil, which sounds dangerous and not legal.
So, green powders?
Green powders.
Does he...
Nope, ambiguous, green powders.
Drugs.
Marijuana, that he mixes with brain octane oil, collagen, and protein. He does say it's all really quite LA, so at least he's self-aware.
Oh, thank God for that.
The celebrities are becoming self-aware. Another favourite bit. Sometimes I'll look at a cow and think, that's the most beautiful thing ever.
Oh, you know what? That I've warmed to him there.
It's quite wholesome. I didn't hate him after it. It was just all very LA. He then spends some time dreaming up movie roles for himself. And also, lest you were worried, minorities and women too. Thank you, Orlando. I'll be awaiting my invite to be in your next Amazon Prime show any day now. If you need a curriculum vitae, then I do have a shaky video of the stand-up set I did in my final year of university.
And this is only the second time she's brought that up on the podcast.
Yeah, I think given what we're on episode 14 of the entire thing now, I think it's pretty bloody impressive. Yeah. You'll be relieved to know that during COVID, Orlando has started building Lego again. The nature of creating this little thing makes him feel like he's achieving something else. Which is great. I'm happy for you, Orlando. It's, you know, it's really important that you get pleasure from the little things.
Yes, yeah.
Then the last line reads, and I think, you know, we can all take something from this. Time is so precious. I was always giving my time to other people before. Now I have the space to dream. And it got me thinking.
And the money.
Yeah, and the money to dream. And it got me thinking. How exciting is my morning routine versus this?
Oh my gosh, have you done your own version?
I've done my own version.
Of course you have.
Listeners, this is an intimate look into my morning. You're welcome.
Here we go.
My alarm clock goes off at 7 a.m. during the week. I bought one of those fancy ones that lights up slowly so as to wake me up calmly. The alarm sound is birdsong, but because it's been my alarm for over 2 years, I now just hate birds. Every morning, I religiously hit the clock at 9-minute intervals, snoozing until it's 8 a.m. I will never cave and actually just set my alarm for 8 a.m. because then the alarm clock wins and I will not be beaten by a man-built machine. Eventually, I drag my lifeless body into the kitchen and make a coffee. People who don't drink coffee frighten me. I don't understand them, and I want to fight them.
Side note, I like coffee, but I don't drink it regularly.
And I want to fight you. I have one of those fancy and cultured Italian stovetop coffee makers that literally screams at me when the coffee is ready. I take a mug of the stuff back to bed and read for a while I drink it. And by read, I mean I open a book, place my phone inside the book, and spend 30 minutes scrolling Instagram. Some mornings I go for a quick walk before work, or I do yoga with my good pal Yoga with Adrienne on YouTube, who is the closest I've come to forming new and healthy relationships during the pandemic. I'm not very good, so this largely consists of me lying on the floor, struggling like a dying beetle in happy baby position, and balking at the fact that this is meant to be an easy position. Everything hurts, all the time, always, forever. After my walk or terrible yoga, I make myself a big smoothie for breakfast. This sounds healthy, but I suspect between the 2 tablespoons of peanut butter, chocolate powder, and dates, it is in fact my daily sugar intake in one glass. I usually add some spirulina. I have no fucking clue what this does, and it smells like stale cum, but it's very green, so I hold my nose and throw it in there anyway and hope it will do something good at some point. At 9:30 a.m. sharp, I sit down at my desk, ready for the day, open my laptop, and scream.
You and Orlando actually do have some parallels there.
We do have a lot of parallels, yeah. I just need to read some Buddhism.
Yeah, you do. And you just need to have the space to dream.
We're already paying a lot for this flat. I don't think we could afford more space to dream. I think our next summer project should be... So, I'm not sure if we mentioned, but we have this weird, like, courtyard at the back of our house, which looks a bit like a warehouse.
It's like, so area. Cool!
It's very cool. Weirdly abandoned and loads of space, and we have direct access to it. And there's, like, a rooftop that you can get onto. It's definitely a life or death situation getting up onto that rooftop, and we've never succeeded. But I would quite like to make that into our roof terrace.
Yeah, that would be nice.
That, I think, should be our summer. And then we'll have so much space to dream.
We'll have the whole sky.
I'm sure there's something in Buddhism. Buddhism?
You were going to say Buddhism.
Buddhism. I'm sure there's something in Buddhism about, you know, roof terraces. What have you been up to this week? Other than putting up with me.
Well, I'm going to talk about some TV I've been watching.
You go, girl. You talk about that TV.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Watch me.
Inject it into my veins.
I didn't know that there was Now TV on the TV.
Yeah, I told you there was Now TV on the TV. I pay for it.
No, but I thought you did the free subscription, then forgot, and so we had it for like 2 months.
Yeah, no, so I did actually do the free trial and forget to cancel, so I can't be bothered to check when it will end, but watch as quickly as you can, because it could get taken away any day now.
Well, that would just be classic, but I've wanted to watch Brassic for ages, because I knew I'd love it, yeah. And guess what?
She loves it.
I absolutely love it. It's basically
what's it about?
A bunch of ragamuffins, and I use that word because they're scoundrels, but like... I use it affectionately, mm-hmm. in the north and in a little town, and it's just essentially they're thieves, but like nice thieves.
Okay.
And it's just all the stuff they get up to.
Do they steal from the rich and give to the poor?
Not like, it's like that vibe, okay. But it's not like, oh, we're good people.
Yeah.
But they're not fucking over anybody who will suffer.
Okay.
The people that get fucked over are not nice, okay. Or like dodgy or very rich and a bit of a wanker.
Oh, we stand that. Vive la revolution.
But I just bloody love it. It's a comedy, but it's also, there are really like heartwarming moments, and like you really care about the characters. Yeah, the perfect balance of lighthearted but like meaningful. It's just fucking funny. Like,
I really hope that our listeners have Now TV.
Me too, mate. And the season 3, I think they're filming at the moment. It can't come soon enough. But yeah, and also in season 2, so the main character, Vinny, is played by, and I cannot remember his name, but he's in This Is England, and he used to be in Coronation Street in Emmerdale. I went through a phase when I was like 7 or 8, where I watched soaps with my grandma, and he was in them then, okay. And then he's like gone on and done other stuff. But in this, he is so likable. I can't put into words. He's a sensitive soul, but he takes no shit. He defends. I'm a bit confused because then in second season, he like has a bit of like a revamp. I'm not going to give things away, but he has a revamp. And then I was like, do I fancy him?
How old is this guy?
I have no idea. Me.
Ambiguously 40?
No, I think young. It's really hard to tell because, like, they could be late 20s. They could be mid 30s. I really don't know. Because of the way they are.
Yeah.
They're young at heart.
You'll be relieved to know, speaking of TV, that the Love Island applications are open. Let's enter, break the system, couple up, win the hearts of the nation, take the money. It doesn't say that people who are friends but in love as friends can't
No, we
win.
Should lie. We should lie and say that we used to go out and there were exes, because then they'll put us in, because yeah. They'll be like, it'll kick off.
But we'll just be friends. And it'll be amazing. And we can just, you can don all of your like summer gear that has watermelons on it and just sit by the pool. And I'll just like spread drama among the other couples.
And I'll get pissed off at you for doing that.
Yeah, but then, like, ultimately, I'm a lovable rogue, so you'll get over it.
Lovable rogue is what they are in Brassic. Lovable okay. rogues.
The only thing is, like, and I mean, honestly, at this point, I'll do anything for a holiday, but I don't think I would do particularly well, because we are not a nation of people that particularly like Camillas. I think because of my name, they wouldn't like me from the offset. I think I would eventually maybe win the hearts of the nation. I don't think I'd win any of the hearts of the men, but I think I'd win the hearts of the nation. But
how do you think you would fare being in a situation where you perpetually don't really know where you stand, and there is also a public vote, and also, oh no, actually, I was going to say, you can't do any of your meals, but you're a bit fed up of cooking, because it's been a whole year of just being inside, so maybe that bit you could enjoy.
Yeah, it sounds like a pressure cooker of all the things that would make me deeply uncomfortable. It really does.
They'd have to be like, okay, so I know your phones are all like disconnected from the internet, but Camilla does have a special dispensation and she will be calling Elle at the end of every day.
Yeah, it would be a lot like that.
I could come in as your, like, what's it called when people,
emotional,
like,
support.
Yes.
Did you try to get me to go on first dates?
Probably.
Also, I will just clarify, when I say that we're a nation of people that don't like Camillas, my evidence for that is the amount of times that I've been tagged in tweets where people are like, what the fuck is wrong with people called Camilla? And then people tag me in that tweet and they're like, oh, this one's nice. And I'm like, do you know what's funny is I wouldn't have seen that tweet if you hadn't tagged me in it.
I don't think I've ever seen a tweet like that.
It's happened like 3 times in the last 3 months. I'm like, look.
You're a Camilla and I'm a Scorpio, so everyone hates us for unwarranted reasons.
I'm a delight. And Elle is very nice as well. She is a bit of a Scorpio, though, I won't fucking lie.
Don't even know what that means.
I don't think you want to. Love Island applications, let's get them in.
I actually have another TV recommendation.
Oh.
Which is The Terror on BBC, so they're all on iPlayer.
Yeah.
It's based on a book by Dan Simmons, and...
Oh, a little bit of crossover action.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
We love to see it. I'm interested in this. It's TV.
And it's about an expedition to the Arctic to find the Northwest Passage. I think that's what it's called. It's got Rime of the Ancient Mariner kind of vibes.
Okay.
Obviously, because they're on ships, and then... But it's very atmospheric. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it's 10 episodes, which is quite a lot.
That is quite a lot.
And they're all, I think, like 50 minutes or an hour. So yeah, but it took me, and my mum said the same. My mum was the one who recommended it to me.
Yeah.
And she said it took me 2 or 3 episodes to get into it. And I was 2 episodes in, and I was like, okay, yeah, I think I like this. And then I saw it was 10 episodes. And weirdly, knowing that it was longer...
More time to get into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I, like, blitzed through it and, like, big, big fan. And now I'm interested to read the book. So, yeah, The Terror. Give it a go.
Give it a whirl. So this week, for judging a book by its cover, I have given Elle Caleb Azuma Nelson's debut novel, Open Water.
So the cover's split in half, and in the upper half is a sort of like a raspberry colour, and the type is blue and says open, and it's a picture of a black man, and then on the bottom half as an orange background, and it's a black woman. So the black man is looking at you, and the black woman is looking down, and then water is over her
as
face.
Per usual, I'll make sure this is on the podcast Instagram so that you can get some visuals. What do you think this is about, Elle?
I've already accepted that everything I'm going to say is probably going to be wrong. Because
that's,
I think,
good.
It's...
Go into it positively.
But I think it's quite hard. I think you can read a lot into what the cover shows you, but I'm very aware that what I'm going to read into probably doesn't correlate to what it's about. Does that make sense?
Okay, well, give it a whirl.
So, open water has connotations of, I guess, stillness and distance and separation.
Mm-hmm.
And also the way the cover is sort of divided in two, speaks to that as well.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out whether I think there's a connection between the two people or whether I think their lives, a bit like on the cover, are running parallel to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then linking with, like, that idea of distance and separation. I feel like there's a difference. If their lives are entangled, there's a difference and there's a level of separation between them.
Yeah.
And if their lives aren't entangled, then I think it's two different trajectories, but obviously a connection in a different way.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I'm going to think that culture and art and aestheticism are important just because of the way that the cover looks and the vibe it gives off.
Yeah.
And also they're both in turtlenecks.
That is the universal mark of a culture person. And
but do you know what I mean? It's a bit like, yeah. It's this sort of, it. The cover looks like it's trying to make me think of art circles and discussions around that
kind of
stuff.
Yeah.
You could read into the fact that the woman is wearing a black turtleneck against an orange background, but the man is wearing a turtleneck which is the same colour as the background. Maybe one of them blends into the background or follows trends or something like that more than the other, and the other one is just trailblazing. I don't know.
Okay. I am going to stop you there. Because you're getting colder. I'll read the, as we do, I'll read the blurb. Two young people meet at a pub in South East London. Both are black British, both won scholarships to private schools where they struggle to belong. Both are now artists. He a photographer, she a dancer. Trying to make their way in a city that by turn celebrates and rejects them. Tentatively, tenderly, they fall in love. But two people who seem destined to be together can still be torn apart by fear and violence. So you've definitely, even though their lives are incredibly intertwined. So essentially, this is a love story set in Southeast London between a young black photographer and a young black female dancer who meet at a party, and they meet through, at the time, the dancer's boyfriend. Obviously, that ends fairly quickly. And there is definitely this kind of current of separation, but not in the way that you would think. Mm-hmm. Their lives are incredibly closely intertwined. The separation grows throughout the book, and it's definitely emotional. Azuma Nelson's writing style is incredibly unique. He writes in the second person, which not a lot of authors...
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, not a lot. And I think it's a really short book.
Yeah, it's diddy.
It's very diddy, and I think...
A slither.
Yeah, and he writes really well in the second person, but I think the only reason he gets away with it, you know, in terms of a novel-length piece, is because the book is shorter. Because it's a difficult style of writing to pull off for, like, 300 pages, because it can get a bit repetitive. Yeah, and there's each chapter kind of has a refrain through it, which gives the book this incredible sense of poetry and rhythm, and it ties in really well with Nelson's kind of constant reference to black artists and artistry and the impact of this culture on the narrator. So it's narrated by the male, by the guy, and the couple become really good friends, and they kind of tussle with whether or not to ruin that friendship by becoming romantically engaged.
That's interesting, because the man looking at you on the cover and the woman looking down,
yeah,
I thought meant something, but that makes sense if he's the one narrating.
Yeah. So the whole thing kind of reads almost like a letter to the narrator's self. He's exploring their relationship over the course of I think it's around a year, and kind of them coming together and moving apart, and the way that they kind of flow around each other, involved in the, they're both very creative, they're both have this feeling of belonging and also this feeling of not belonging, and that's explored throughout the book. And essentially it centers on not only their love story, but the narrator's growing anxiety and fear around various run-ins where he or his friends, people in his area, are unfairly targeted by the police. It's a really, like, this is a brilliant book. I would recommend everybody read this. It's such a beautiful and tender exploration of intimacy and first love. But there's this really unsettling, violent current that runs underneath. As Azuma Nelson, he kind of really emotively demonstrates how these pressures influence black men's psychic lives. So kind of their inner lives. And the way that they create connections with other people and that sense of trust, which is eroded by this constantly being watched and targeted. And eventually it just, as it would do, it gets to him. And it's a really emotional look at how that tears him apart. And the relationship that that has to the other people that he's engaging with. And I don't want to give too much away, but it is just a really strong piece of writing. And you really want the characters to kind of succeed and to...
Yeah, you're invested.
Yeah. And in a way, there isn't really a resolution at the end of it, as there often isn't in life, which I think works really well for the book.
Yeah, that makes me like it more.
Yeah, it's really raw and it's very striking, and it's hopeful in a way that just celebrates the exuberance of black art and culture and gutting in the way that it portrays institutionalized racism and the very personal impact this has on the lives of young Black men in London. It's obviously a very specific microcosm. Obviously, it's something that happens around the world, but mm-hmm. this kind of look at it is a moment, you know, spread out over a book.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll really like the love story and the way that that's portrayed mm-hmm. and the way that they move between like friendship and love and romantic love mm-hmm. and kind of testing the borders and when do you get the confidence to take that step and what are the repercussions?
Yeah, for sure.
And there's also loads of great musical references and artist references, and it's wonderful the way that Izumi Nelson writes about stuff that he's clearly really passionate about. It does a lot for such a small book. On the flip side, another book that I just finished, which is also about love, but very different love, is Happy All the Time by Laurie Colwyn. This proof was really kind of gifted to me. It's from the W&N Essentials, which is where they're kind of rehashing or recovering, reissuing classics, modern classics written by women.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Happy All the Time by Laurie Colwyn.
I love the cover. It makes me want to have breakfast.
Yeah, the cover has like a breakfast tray on it with some toast and tea and the New York News and a little flower pot.
It makes you want to eat toast.
It makes you want to eat toast. I'll read the blurb. It was just as she suspected. Love turned you into perfect mush. Guido is not in the habit of falling in love with women he sees in museums, until he meets Holly. Precise about everything, she knows what she likes. Pressed sheets, oranges, but nothing orange-flavoured. Tea on a tray, and now, Guido. Meanwhile, Vincent, Guido's eternally cheerful best friend and cousin, falls for his misanthropic new colleague, Misty. She seems as uninterested in love as she is in Vincent, at first. Through courtship, arguments, wedding plans, and other perils, the couples find a way to be happy almost all the time. This is, oh my god, I finished it this morning and I almost cried because I loved it so, so, so much. It's such a wonderful book. It's much lighter than Open Water and a very different style of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a delightful little book. I was emotional finishing, not because it was sad, but because it's so generous and kind in the way that it looks at relationships and love. It reminded me a little bit of Nora Ephron.
Did it feel like a friend?
Felt like a friend. Felt like you wanted to just climb in and sit at their dinner parties.
Yeah.
And be there and be surrounded by these people who were so in love with each other. But not in a way that's... I know that it says love turns you into perfect mush, but it's not.
Not like saccharine.
It's not saccharine at all. It's like Nora Ephron, the way that she writes it. Yeah, if you like anything by Nora Ephron, I really think you'll enjoy this. And even if you don't enjoy anything by Nora Ephron, I think you'll love this anyway.
I've never read anything by Nora.
My turn to
Does
be
that
outraged.
Surprise you, though?
I think you'd really like Heartburn. It's a book about food and love and everything that you love.
Yeah, Heartburn, it's one of those things I'm just waiting. You know when someone tells you to read something?
Yeah.
I'm very contrary in that. Like, when things are being raved about, nope. When someone's like, read that, nope. I'll read it. I know I will. I'm just taking my time.
I'll leave my copy lying around. My well-read copy of Heartburn.
Yeah. I'll read it this summer.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to read it
this summer. It's a good summer book. But yeah, Colwyn's writing is incredibly witty. I think I was visibly smiling through at least half of the book. I'm going to read a little passage from it that I sent to Elle, because it's basically Elle and I. Maybe part of the reason I loved it so much was that you remind me a bit of Vincent, and I think there are parts of me that remind me of Guido. I'll read a little bit. Guido was not in the habit of falling in love with girls he saw on buses or in museums. He had had two serious love affairs and a small number of casual encounters. These he tried not to think about. They had puzzled and hurt him. He explained to himself that he was an old-fashioned man living in modern times, shackled with the belief that all real love affairs led to marriage. If they did not, they must be in some way bogus, built on bad faith or lack of true emotion. Therefore, they were bad. Once they were over, no matter how ardently one had begun. The casual encounters Guido chalked up to sheer impulse. You could not call something that lasted for a day a love affair. Vincent tried to explain that these things were a matter of process, the process of growing up. But this was no consolation to Guido. In the case of his two serious love affairs, the partings had been equitable but not understandable. Both the girls had married and sent him cards at Christmas time. Where, he wondered, had all the feeling gone? A really charming look at love and kind of the mystery of it, and the balance of falling in love with somebody for exactly who they are and then having to live with exactly who they are,
if
that makes sense. So, like, Guido is, you know, he thinks out loud a lot. He needs to talk things through. He's very expressive. And Holly is very... The woman that he marries is quite cut and dry. She's mm-hmm. like, I don't talk about how I feel. I just feel and get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of why he loves her. And there's a bit at the end of the book where he's like, if I had married somebody like myself, we'd never get anything done because we'd just be talking all the time about how we felt. So I think, but obviously it's those traits in her that he loves so much that cause strains on their marriage and that put them through their paces. And I think it's just I just love this book so much. You know, Colwyn is so insightful and gentle and wise in the way that she explores dating and married life. And yeah, I mean, again, just back to like Guido and Vincent take such different approaches to love, but they come across the same problems.
Yeah.
And I think I've talked about it before, but the way that we all go through love and the way that we experience love is so dependent on who we are as people, but those universal problems persist.
Yeah.
Like, how do you live with somebody where the things that you love about them might also be the things that make them hard to live with? And I think everybody has those traits where it's like they're admirable.
Somebody fitting into the life you want for yourself is not the same thing.
Yeah.
And you deciding what's more important is growing up.
Yeah.
For sure. When you sent me that extract, also, I've picked up the book and put it on the pile with the other one. Because
I really, really think you'll like it.
Well, that extract and the way it's written reminds me of
Anita Broder's A Star in Life.
Yeah. Which I spoke about last year. I definitely want to give that a go.
I think it might be...
Oh my gosh, she's about to say something big.
I don't want to say it's my new favourite book, because...
But it's my new favourite book.
I don't have favourite children, but it's definitely up there in, like, the top three.
Yeah, you love it.
I love books about love. As
I love love.
I love love. You called me a sap, didn't you?
Yes, but I said it affectionately.
So... Elle called me a sap, and then we watched
Which was fine.
But again, I'm only a sap with you. Everyone else thinks I'm very cool and calm. Elle sees a side to me that, well, now you podcast listeners, we'll see. I can be a bit of a sap, but I keep that
you
side.
Also, you call yourself a sap around
only
me.
With you.
Okay.
So Elle called me a sap. Fine. We then watched, as we discussed last week, the first movie of the Lord of the Rings series. And what's his name? What's the...
Samwise Gamgee.
So what did you say? You were like, Samwise Gamgee is such a sap and I hate it.
because...
It was just very soon after you called me a sap.
Yes, but you had called yourself a sap and then I'd called you a sap. But that was different to me. And I still think maybe calling Samwise Gamgee a sap was wrong. But he's just so annoying. His whole thing is just Frodo. And it's like, get a grip.
Yeah, to be fair, I'm not that much of a sap.
No, you're a sap, but you've got other things going on. Samwise Gamgee is sap. That he is.
He just loves Frodo. Anyway, we won't turn this into another Lord of the Rings. Lord and the Rings. Lord of the Rings. Episode. But yeah, so Laurie Colwyn is also a food writer, so I'm really excited to read some of her food writing, which I think leads us nicely onto the books you're going to talk about.
What a perfect segue.
Absolute expert.
So for my birthday, which was last November, Camilla got me In the Kitchen.
I absolutely nailed it, guys. Outstanding birthday gifts from me.
Which is a collection of essays on food and life. I really love the front cover of it so much. It's just a kitchen, but I just love it so much. Nigel Slater says, a delightful collection of original, vibrant and heartwarming writing.
So what's been the best essay that you've read in it?
Okay, I'm not going to lie to you. I have, I think, three left to go.
Yeah.
But I was like, if they change my life, I'll just talk about them at a later date.
Yeah, that's the thing about like short stories. You can dip in and out.
I think thus far my favourite is the first one, which is A Life in Cookers by Rachel Roddy. It's interesting because I don't really rate memoir, but because this is kind of a memoir.
Yeah.
But because it's done via the different cookers in her life, it doesn't feel...
self-indulgent.
Yeah. Which is funny, but...
Elle and I do not agree on memoir.
Yeah, I'm just like, if you want to write about your life, do it via something else.
Find a metaphor.
But it's interesting because obviously you use a cooker all the time. And then I was like, all the cookers in my life. And then I thought about the one in my uni house, and I was like, and it's really funny because when you wouldn't think about it, but when you think about all the cookers in your life,
I don't think I've had that much of a connection to the cookers, but that's because I'm not really a cook.
But not even having a connection, just being like remembering that like you had to turn that knob like the whole way around, or you had to, like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Quirks of like appliances.
And I cannot stress this enough, so hard for me not to make an innuendo.
I know.
So hard for me.
It was hard for me as well. And now I wish I'd just done it.
I'm like a teenage boy. It's ridiculous.
They go in different directions.
Have you read Joel Golby's one yet?
No. And oh. I knew that would be a sticking point.
So Joel Golby is a very funny writer. He has a brilliant book. His book is called Brilliant, 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 Brilliant. And it's a very funny collection of stories if you're looking for a good book to read.
His essay in this is Who Are You When No One Is Watching? There was also, oh my gosh, which one is it? I can't even remember. I think it was The Future of Food was an interesting one because it was talking about Huel. And food as fuel, yeah. And like HelloFresh boxes, and like how that, yeah, and like social media, and how that's
I all almost come into the picture. Caved a few weeks ago and bought Huel because I was like, I just cannot
It would make you so unhappy, though. I think
I know. I think it would, but I was just like, I just cannot bear the thought of having to make myself lunch again. This endless cycle of lunch every day. It's just lunch.
One of my favourites, which was by Rebecca May Johnson, is Against Roast Chicken, an hors d'oeuvre theory of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that is all about the film Mermaids,
oh,
which I text you about.
Yeah.
Which I know sounds ridiculous because we live together, but if Camilla's gone to bed and I have something to say...
She'll text me. Sometimes just when you're upstairs and...
Yeah, but if I'm working and I'm about to go on a call,
yeah,
I can't just...
Hey, I do the same thing.
Yeah, but more often than not, you come to my room.
Yeah, that's just because I want to talk to you. I love going and annoying Elle when she's in the middle of a busy work day and just, like, thinking out loud for, like, half an hour in her room while she just works and doesn't really... No, you do engage with me.
No, I think I do quite a good job, actually, of multitasking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I give you what you need, and I'm also giving my colleagues what they need.
Dream team, you, yourself, and you.
But yeah, so that essay is all... Because I read the title, and I was like, not sure. I don't like the vibe of this. Like,
mm-hmm.
I love canapes and hors d'oeuvres, but that doesn't mean that... Why are we... I don't even eat chicken, but why are we against roasting a chicken?
Is there a difference between a canapé and an hors d'oeuvre?
There is. Is there? Or is that one Americans use and one's European? P&Z's. Because then we can also talk about amuse-bouche.
Okay, and now I'm like, where does amuse-bouche fit into this?
Traditionally, canapés are made with an edible base, crackers or breads. If you pick up a piece of salmon on a cracker from a passing tray, it is a canapé, yes. The same fish served with a fancy sauce, a hors d'oeuvre. Yes, but I was going to say, I feel like a canapé is on like a Bellini or a cracker or some bread.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe an hors d'oeuvre is on like a spoon, you know, when they have those little spoons.
So an hors d'oeuvre is a little bit saucy.
Yes, essentially, that's what we're getting here. But yeah, and so that I really enjoyed that essay. It looks at the film Mermaids, mm-hmm. which has Cher and...
Oh, I fucking love Cher.
Who's Wednesday Addams in the Addams Family?
Oh.
Do you know who I'm talking about, though?
Christina Ricci.
Yes, and Winona Ryder. They're mermaids.
Love it.
And it's talking about their relationship with cooking, especially Cher, who plays the mother.
Yeah.
And she just doesn't cook any meals. And it's a really interesting sort of takes apart, like, the roast chicken.
Yeah.
Like, family meal and sort of dad carving the chicken.
Yeah.
And sort of talks about how they eat.
Yeah.
In their family as subverting the expectations of, like, gender roles and being a woman.
Kind yeah.
of. So that was a really interesting one. And now I really want to watch Mermaids now.
Yeah. I prepare meals a bit like that sometimes because I like very particular things and sometimes I like things that don't necessarily go together.
Yeah, like bitty.
So I'll often have a dinner of, like, bitty bits and just entirely unconnected parts, but I'm like... But I want a yogurt pot and I also want some baked beans, but I also want a salmon fillet.
Sometimes I'm the same. And it's when it's a novelty, I'm like...
Novelty.
This is fun. because I've just got that because I want it, and that because I want it, and that because I want it.
Yeah, and I'm an adult, and if I want to, if I want to have a weird ass dinner, I can do that.
Weird tapas.
So my question for you, and I was thinking of this earlier because I knew you were going to talk about this book. What three things, like what are your top three kitchen cupboard staples or fridge? What three things do you always have in stock? So I've got tomato chutney.
Yes.
Always.
Yes, always.
Like, I cannot not have tomato chutney. Peanut butter.
Yeah.
Usually 2 kilo vats in my cupboard. And I was thinking about what the third one was, and I think it's probably eggs.
Yeah. I was like, I can easily do yours. Yeah. And it's those three.
It is those three things. I always have them. And together they do not make a meal.
It's harder for me. I think this is what's different. Yeah. I don't have, they're not the same. Like, the staples I have for cooking
yeah.
are not the staples that I, like, I always have Granny Smith apples.
You do, yeah. Ooh, oh, I do always have bananas. Actually, to be fair, the only thing you always have is basically Granny Smith apples.
I always have Granny Smith apples. And then when it comes to cooking, always have passata. Always have Knorr stock pots.
Yeah.
And always have Marmite, because I use Marmite in all, like, stocks and...
Yeah.
Marmite is an incredible thing to cook with, because even if you don't like Marmite, it gives, like, bolsters flavours in cooking so well.
Yeah.
So in terms of, like, a store cupboard essential, those would be... those. And also caramelised red onion chutney, whether I've made it or I've bought it, that's really good for the same reason that Marmite is. You can stick it in, like, a bolognese or any sauce, and it'll just give a bit of something.
Well, this is how I feel about tomato chutney and or peanut butter, is that there is not a meal that you could not put either tomato chutney or peanut butter on. And I use peanut butter liberally as a condiment. Liberally. I've gone through 4 kilos this year.
That, you know, I did the maths earlier. I can't remember what it was now, but I was trying to figure out, like, how much is she going through a week?
A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot. A lot.
I would look like Kate Moss if I didn't eat as much peanut butter as I do. But you know what? I'm not willing to give it up. Because that shit is good.
Yeah. I've always liked it, but never been mad on it. But definitely in the past year, you have opened... not opened my eyes because they were closed.
We do not allow peanut butter ambivalence in this house.
I actively like it now. Good. Because I must.
It is a rule of the house. You must always bring us gifts, and you must ardently love peanut butter. Or hate it. I'm open to either.
Just like...
you cannot be ambivalent about peanut butter in this house.
I feel like lots of people probably are, though.
And they are not allowed in our house.
And then another book that is one of, like, the big books in my life is Philosophers at Table on Food and Being Human, which is by Raymond D. And how would you say his last name?
I would not.
Is it Boisvert?
I think you've got to go full French. We're back to this
I
problem.
Think it might be Boisvert, though.
Boisvert.
Or Boisvert. Or Boisvert.
Boisvert. Boisvert. Boisvert. It's Boisvert.
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 Raymond D. Boisvert. Is it, though?
Yeah, because if his first name is Raymond, he's French.
Raymond de Boisvert. Yeah, no, it is Boisvert.
Yeah.
And if it's not, it should be.
Lean into it, Raymond.
And then Lisa Heldk.
Heldk.
I thought you were going to say that so much better than me because of Danish, but no.
Is she Danish? That's not a Danish name.
But that's like Scandinavian.
That's some Norwegian shit. I don't know how to pronounce that.
Heldk?
Heldeker.
Heldeker.
Heldeker. Heldeker.
Heldeker. Oh, I'd have never gone there.
Heldeker.
Okay, well, that was a fun lesson for everybody.
There we go. We should... how many minutes on this podcast have we just spent ruining people's last names?
I just feel like I have to say it, because if I've got it wrong, I need it to be, like, on record that, like...
you tried.
I tried. Yeah. I don't want people thinking I think I'm right when I'm saying it wrong. Yeah. Do you know, I'm covering my tracks. Also... growing up, having people mispronounce my name the whole time.
How do you mispronounce heirs?
Oh my god, you'd be amazed. And also...
do they go like Ayres?
Yes.
Okay, well.
So many Americans, actually.
I'm so sorry.
Aries. Lots of people just struggling. Lots of people just like...
You just, it's almost like a breath, airs.
Yeah. Like it's a very breath elegant. Of fresh air. I do like my name. But then also perpetually being called Eleanor when I'm Eleanor.
I simply just call you L.
L, Ellie, any manner of other nicknames I have, absolutely fine. But do not call me Eleanor.
She will fight you.
I'll read you the back. Why not?
We're going to blurb this shit up.
There'll probably be more words on the back that I panic and
would you
I
like,
can...
Would you like me to read the back?
No, I can do this, but be prepared.
We can read.
I get stage fright. One of the most important things we do every day is eat. The question of eating, what and how, may seem simple at first, but it is dense with possible interpretations, reflecting the myriad roles food plays in our lives. In fact, as Raymond and Lisa show in this book, deliberately just didn't repeat their surnames then. Their surnames are on the blurb, but I'm not going through that again. Show in this book, it's difficult to imagine a more philosophically charged act than eating. Philosophers at Table explores the philosophical scaffolding that supports this crucial aspect of everyday life, showing that humans are not just creatures with minds, but creatures with stomachs. Examining a wealth of myths, literary works, histories and films, as well as philosophical ideas, the authors make the case for a philosophy of food. They look at Babette's feast in a discussion of hospitality as a central ethical virtue. They compare eating a fast food meal in Accra, I don't know what that is, with dining at a molecular gastronomy restaurant as a way of considering the nature of food as art. And they describe biting into a slug to explore tasting as a learning tool, a way of knowing. A surprising original take on something we have not philosophically savoured enough, Philosophers at Table invites readers to think in fresh ways about the simple and important act of eating. And can I just say, when they say that it's not been philosophically looked at enough, I can confirm that is true, because when I did my dissertation, this is like the only book, like the only one. There were like some scattered essays that I had to like bend to like be able to use. But yeah, it's really not, maybe it's been done more now, but my God, it's the surface has not been scratched. But this is, I think I read this first when I was at school, and I remember seeing it and just being like, yes. I mean, really, really, just I just knew I was going to be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, then I kind of already, for like a while, knew what I wanted to do my dissertation on.
Yeah.
Which was the sort of like phenomenology and the idea of the internal, external, and how we navigate the world and our subjective experiences. But this was definitely quite pivotal, mainly because, yeah, there just really isn't that much out there on the philosophy of food. And it is such like fundamental aspect of living.
Yeah.
Which is weird that there's not been more done on it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was definitely super pivotal in just my general, it sounds weird, but like my general outlook.
So what kind of points are they making in it? Because I've not read I've not read anything on the philosophy of food.
You haven't even read my dissertation.
I haven't read your dissertation.
Your loss, baby.
You didn't read my dissertations.
I wanted to. You didn't send them to me. Oh. Actually, I have read a bit of one of them. Something that had a big impact in like how I was thinking about it.
Yeah.
The idea of eating and tasting being like testing and curiosity.
Yeah.
And that gave birth to the whole idea of the boundary. Yeah. And something going from the external to the internal.
Yeah.
So that definitely, thinking about things like that,
mm-hmm.
definitely came out of this book. And there's one quote in it. It might be good to be goaded by a force that counterbalances our tendencies to turn in on ourselves. So that got me thinking about, so food, and I think one of the reasons it talks about this and rationality is that food is seen quite like base.
Yeah.
Like we need it to survive. And I think that's probably a quite of a big reason why it's not been looked at more philosophically. Yeah. And so then I was thinking about how, but there's all these other things like hospitality and socialization and all these things are like inextricably linked to how we eat.
Yeah.
Because I know that this book, like, gave me loads of ideas, but sort of uncovered things or made me clarify thoughts I'd already had.
Yeah.
So it talks about being human means to taste and to test. So while philosophers have often preferred rational as a label for humans, a more literal translation of sapiens would identify us as the tasting species. Sapiens derives from a verb sapere, which means to think or discern, or to taste and smell.
Ah.
Yeah, so just like breaking it down and stripping it all back.
Yeah.
How it talks about the sort of philosophical plumbing of an argument and how we think about all that and the sort of technical sides of that, but then also how we live.
Yeah.
And with food, the way it strings all that together and sort of connects the dots with food is really, really interesting. I think, and also it's accessible. Yes, it is academic, but it's not isolating at all. And the turn of phrase is very accessible.
We all eat. Girls gotta eat.
Exactly, exactly. But yeah, it's such a fantastic book. And definitely...
Also, I think, and obviously this is very much part of the society that we live in and the position that we have in the world. But food is not something that we eat because we have to eat most of the time. You know, it
exactly.
It is, I think, for us, a social experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I've always, you know, I've always think it's easiest to love somebody when you're sharing a good meal with them.
Well, so then I did my dissertation on sex and food and how both those practices were fundamental to surviving, but also fundamental to our subjective interior lives.
Yeah.
Because both are, like, base, in inverted commas.
Yeah, yeah.
But we attach really important higher-order concepts.
Yeah.
So, like I said before, hospitality and manners...
Yeah.
...are so connected to both, and both involve external and internal crossing of a boundary... and sort of grounding you in life whilst yeah. also being very up in your head.
Yeah.
And I forgot, but I remembered literally just now, that for a uni paper, they were doing like a feature on like weird and wonderful
yeah.
dissertations. And I did one explaining my dissertation. So I thought, I'll read this because it was for an external audience who don't do philosophy, so yeah. It'll probably make more sense. Sex and food, arguably what many would cite as the best things in life. They are undeniably fundamental aspects of what it is to be a human being, and they occupy a similar importance in both the private and the public realms of humanity. My interest is in seeing how our intentional understandings, i.e. the power of our minds to be about something, to constitute meanings, are ever present in how we approach both sex and food. Finding a parallel between both and in bonding them together in such a way, positing an appreciation of what human life is through sensual pleasure and how sensual pleasure is as much mental as it is physical. We view sex and food as base and animalistic, but we also attach higher order concepts such as trust, hospitality, creativity, and love to such practices, ideals which help to shape our world and attach meanings to it. So through sex and food and all the mess that comes with it, both figuratively and literally, we have an understanding of ourselves as embodied minds, our connection as almost a first-person boundary between the material world and the mental world is realised when we eat and cook, when we desire and have sex. Just something to think about next time you're post-coital and eating pizza in bed. You're welcome.
The ideal state.
So whilst you can't read my dissertation, because unfortunately it has not been published, you can read Philosophers at Table. And I would recommend that you do.
So I'm going to try and make this cocktail better by adding more lemon and lime juice.
Yeah, because it will cut through the sweetness. So
let's see if that helps. Let's give it a whirl. Because I've not... It's been a bit too sweet for me. It's given me a headache. That is much better. It's still a bit too much, but...
Can I try?
Mm-hmm. So make that 80 milliliters of citrus juice.
Whoa! Now I think it needs more gin. This is just the endless. We just keep adding.
Just the endless cocktail. So what are you hating this week?
What am I hating?
Don't come at me with that shit again where you can't think of anything. The world is at stake.
I've made sure I've got something. So I don't want to jinx it, but it might not be such an issue now. but my knee was giving me jib, and I didn't understand why.
Because
I could run on it fine and walk on it fine, but if I, like, if walking up and downstairs, like, bending it, I could just feel it.
Yeah.
It was hard to explain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know why, but I think we might be all right.
In the clear.
All right now. And then sort of...
tangentially.
Yes, to that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my oldest and dearest friends has just moved in around the corner, and we used to run together, and now we're running together again.
Yeah.
Which is great. But now I'm quite concerned that I've become codependent and I can't run on my own. And I had, like, actual anxiety.
How many runs have you been on with this person?
In my life or recently?
Since they moved around the corner.
4.
How many runs have you been on this year?
Yes, I know, but I didn't... But it's because I didn't have any confidence in myself when I was running on my own. And I thought I was awful. And now...
I told you that you looked... Elle ran past me in Battersea Park, didn't realise that she had... She looks like an elegant little gazelle when she runs. It's beautiful.
That did make me feel a lot better.
So much joie de vivre.
I am quite bouncy.
Yeah, you're very bouncy. Yeah. Honestly, I run like I've got weights in my ankles. No wonder my entire body is broken.
But no, to be fair, that did make me feel better. And then when I went on a run with May, she was like, "You're as good as me." And like, in my head, May is a good runner. So that's good. We're back on track. Feeling good about myself. But then I was like, I want to go on a run, but May was busy. And I was like, but I really want to go on a run, but also I don't want to go on my own because I think I'll feel rubbish. And this went on for a few days.
Mm.
And then I went on a run before work this morning and I didn't enjoy it as much, but I did do it. It you wasn't didn't. Terribly good. It was first thing, so I don't think I even did 3K. I think I did like 2.5 or something.
Better than nothing.
Well, yeah, exactly. I just did like a little loop.
It's good to get the old heart going in the morning. That's why I do my yoga and my walk.
Well, it was nice weather as well. And I think I was quite speedy. Oh. So, you know, but I just didn't really... This is what I find interesting, is you can go on a run. I think this is why people use Strava. This is my... Or maybe not deliberately, but like unconsciously, I feel like this might be why.
Yeah.
Because if you go on a run... And you think you do badly and you feel a bit rubbish. But you have stats.
Yeah.
That say you've done, like, as normal or better than normal. Or do you know what I mean? Then you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I do sometimes use the Nike Run app because everyone can mind their own business about where and how I'm running and how fast I'm doing it. Thank you very much. But it does feel good when you get that thing that's like, hey, you ran, like, a little bit further today than you normally do.
But then I guess the other side of that is if you felt... like really good about a run, but then you looked and were like, oh, then you wouldn't. But I guess if you're already feeling good, it's not gonna matter.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're feeling rubbish and then you see it and it looks good, then it'll make you feel a bit better.
Yeah.
But yeah, so basically my boring dislike of the week is my conflicted relationship with running and potential codependency. But other than that, we're grand, so
everything's going swell. I've got ants in my pants.
Literally.
Figuratively, thank God. Thank God. They're not going to get into my pants that easy. I ain't no hussy. I've got ants in my pants. I've been really restless the last... Well, you've been on the receiving end of it. I've been very restless, like, the last weekish. Just very, like, on edge. And I think it's for a lot of things. But I think part of it is definitely... Like, the days are getting longer, the weather's getting a bit nicer, it smells like spring.
Mm, spring has sprung.
Spring has sprung. I just want to be out and doing things, but we're not allowed to do things. The vibe in general is more positive, so I'm, like, feeling a bit more positive about life, but still can't do anything, really. It's a bit cold to do picnics in the evening. You know, and it's the sort of weather where you want to be out, and really, I know exactly what the solution is. I know exactly what the solution is.
The pub?
No, it's very specific. It's a night in Thirsties in Soho. Sorry, Thirsty in Soho, which is the third worst club in Soho.
I've not even heard
The worst club in Soho is Zebrano's. The second worst club in Soho is Simmons. And Thirsty is the third worst club in Soho. And it's great because you start off somewhere classy like Milroy's. Where you care about how good your drinks are. And then you go to Thirsty, which is far too small.
Thirsty just sounds...
decrepit. It's brilliant. It's the best place in Soho. I love it so much. It's so bad. So it's like a cocktail bar upstairs that's way too small and has no reasonable seating that makes any sense. Everything is either an awkward wall bench or a table that's way too high.
Ah, fabulous.
So you're always not quite sure where you are, but you're always a bit drunk by the time you get there.
You shouldn't be sitting. You should be dancing.
So they've got a club downstairs that plays a lot of Britney Spears. Whenever I get, like, ants in my pants, a bit restless like this, normally what I would do is I'd be like, right, I need to have, like, a big night out in Soho. That's a good, get it out your system. It's a Thursday night. You look at your watch and it's like, fuck, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I need to be at work tomorrow. You get home at 3, you wake up and you just lavish in your hangover at work. And I can't do any of that. That kind of going out. And I know, like, generally the pub would help, but it is very specifically, I need a good bad night out walking around Soho, ending up in Thirsty, getting home too late, having a Pret tuna toastie at work the next day with everyone looking at me like I smell like vodka.
Because I do.
Because I probably do.
I just need a good night out. I just need a night out. Please.
I'll take you to Thirsty. I take...
That sounds like a weird pickup line.
It is not that good, but it is always where I end up, and it has a
They're
real special.
They're your favourite places, though, aren't they?
Exactly.
You like bad clubs, but...
I do like bad clubs, but what I like most about this is it's not just a bad club. It's also a bad cocktail bar.
Let's take each other to different places when it's all over.
It's like Aladdin. I can show you the world. Shining, shimmering, Soho.
No, but it's true, because you'd show me a world that I wouldn't see.
That you would not actively seek out. The filthy underside of Britney Spears London.
Exactly. We can...
I'll take you somewhere classy too. We'll go to Scarves Bar at the Rosewood, which is...
Oh, yes.
Which is
nice.
My favourite bar in London.
I worked in the event at the Rosewood once.
Yeah. But I only go there once a year because all of the cocktails cost £20. But they're so good and there's jazz music and you feel like an adult.
Do you know where somewhere I haven't been, which I just feel like I need to go to just tick it off the list, is Sky Garden.
I've also not been to Sky Garden.
Oh, right. Well, okay, well, we'll definitely do that then. We'll definitely book that in now.
I'm
for, like,
sure.
3 years' time.
Do you know what? Honestly, it takes that long to get a reservation in normal times.
Yeah, exactly.
Better times are coming. I've got ants in my pants, but they'll be released soon.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I've heard that now. And I do regret saying it.
Okay, if you release them, can you just shut the door so they don't, like, scurry?
It will be untamable. And on that note...
Au revoir and stay excellent.
Hasta la vida, same.
If you've enjoyed listening to Pros Before Hoes, please remember to rate, review and subscribe. Otherwise, we'll have no idea.